Chapter 2. Pontius Pilate. In a white cape, with blood-red lining, shuffling with a cavalryman's gait, early in the morning, on the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan, there emerged on the covered colonnade between the two wings of Herod the Great's palace the procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate. More than anything in the world, the procurator hated the smell of rose oil. Right now, everything heralded an unpleasant day, for the smell had been haunting him since dawn. It seemed as though the very cypresses and palms in the garden oozed the odour, as though the stream of rosy stench mixed into the smell of leather tackle, the smell of the guards. A faint smoke drifted into the colonnade, through the upper terrace of the garden, originating in the rear wings of the palace, where the first cohort of the 12th Lightning Legion had been stationed after accompanying the procurator to Jerusalem. Indicating that the sentry's cooks had started preparing dinner, this bitter smoke mingled with the same oily rose breath. Oh, gods, ye gods, why do you punish me so?
There is no doubt. It's back again, the incurable, horrific disease known as hemicrania, when half the head aches, there is no medicine, no salvation of any sort. I will try not to move my head.
An armchair had already been prepared on the mosaic floor by the fountain. Looking at no one, the procurator sat in it and extended his hand to the side. The secretary respectfully placed a piece of parchment in the hand. Unable to suppress a grimace of pain, the procurator glanced over it briefly, returned the parchment to the secretary, and said with difficulty,
"The defendant comes from Galilee. Has the case been sent to the Tetrarch?"
"Yes, procurator," the secretary replied.
"What of it?"
"He refused to form a conclusion on the case and sent the Sanhedrin's death sentence to you for confirmation," the secretary explained. The procurator's cheek twitched as he said quietly,
"Bring in the accused."
From the garden terrace, two legionnaires immediately brought in a man about 27 years of age and stood him under the columns on the balcony in front of the procurator's chair. The man wore an old and torn blue chiton. His head was covered by a piece of white cloth, secured by a strap round his brow, and his hands were bound behind his back. His left eye was decorated with a large bruise, and the corner of his mouth was caked with blood. The visitor looked at the procurator with anxious curiosity. The procurator was silent for a moment, then asked quietly in Aramaic,
"So you are the one who incited the people to destroy the temple of Jerusalem?"
Throughout all this, the procurator sat as though made of stone, and only his lips moved ever so slightly as he pronounced the words. The procurator was like a stone because he was afraid to disturb his head, which blazed with infernal pain. The bound man moved forward slightly and began to speak. "Good man, believe me." But the procurator cut him off immediately, never moving and never raising his voice.
"Is it me you call a good man? You are mistaken. All of Jerusalem whispers that I am a vicious beast, and that is absolutely right."
And just as monotonously he added,
"Bring me Centurion Ratslayer."
It was as though darkness had descended on the balcony when the centurion appeared before the procurator. Mark, nicknamed Ratslayer, commander of a special sentry. Ratslayer stood a head above the tallest soldier in the legion, and his shoulders were so broad that he blocked the rising sun completely as he stood. The procurator spoke to the centurion in Latin.
"The criminal calls me a good man. Take him outside for a moment and explain how he is to address me, but no maiming."
All eyes but those of the motionless procurator followed Mark, the rat-slayer, as he walked away, waving at the prisoner to follow. Eyes generally followed Rat Slayer wherever he appeared, on account of his height, and, for those who saw him for the first time, on account of his disfigured face. His nose had once been smashed by a German club. Mark's heavy boots sounded off on the mosaic, and the bound man followed him noiselessly, leaving the colonnade silent, but for the cooing of pigeons on the garden terrace by the balcony, and the intricate, pleasant song of the water in the fountain. The procurator wished he could rise, place his temple under the stream, and freeze in that position. But he knew that this too would be futile. Leading the arrestee from under the columns into the garden, Rat Slayer took a whip from the hands of a legionnaire standing at the foot of a bronze statue. Swinging gently, he struck the captive on the shoulders. The centurion's motion was light and casual, but the bound man collapsed instantly to the ground, gasping for air, as though his legs had been cut out from under him. All colour fled from his face, and his eyes clouded. With his left hand, Mark hoisted the fallen man back on his feet as easily as if it had been an empty sack, and spoke in poor, nasal Aramaic.
"You will address the Roman procurator as hegemon. Say nothing else. Stand at attention. Do you understand, or shall I hit you again?"
The prisoner swayed, but regained control of himself. His colour returned. He caught his breath and replied hoarsely, "I understand you. Don't hit me." A minute later, he again stood before the procurator. A dim, sickly voice said, "Name?" "Mine," the prisoner replied hastily, expressing with all his being the desire to provide coherent answers and avoid further wrath. "I am acquainted with my own," the procurator said quietly. "Do not pretend to be dumber than you are. Yours?" "Yeshua," the prisoner replied hurriedly. "Have you a surname?"
"Hanotzri." "Where were you born?"
"In the town of Gamala," replied the prisoner, motioning with his head that somewhere, far to his right, to the north, lay the town of Gamala.
"Who are you by blood?"
"I do not know for sure," the prisoner said quickly. "I do not remember my parents. I've been told my father was a Syrian."
"What is your permanent residence?"
"I have no permanent residence," the prisoner said bashfully. "I travel from town to town."
"There is a shorter name for that. A vagrant," the procurator said, and then asked, "Have you relatives?"
"None. I am alone in the world."
"Can you read and write?"
"Yes."
"Do you know any languages besides Aramaic?"
"Yes. Greek."
A swollen eyelid lifted slightly, an eye clouded with suffering stared at the prisoner.
The other eye remained closed. Pilate spoke in Greek.
"So, you wanted to destroy the building of the temple and called on the people to do so?"
The prisoner livened up again, the fear left his eyes, and he spoke in Greek.
"Good man..."
Terror flashed in the eyes of the captive, for he had nearly misspoken.
"Hegemon,
never in my life have I intended to destroy the building of the temple, and I certainly never incited anyone to such a senseless act." An expression of surprise appeared on the face of the secretary, who was hunched over his low table recording the testimony. He raised his head, but leaned back over his parchment immediately.
"Numerous people drift into this city for the holiday, among them magicians, astrologers, soothsayers, and murderers," the procurator spoke monotonously, "and occasionally liars. You, for instance, are a liar. It is clearly written here, incited to destroy the temple, so say the witnesses."
"Those good people," said the prisoner, and hastily adding, "Hegemon," continued, "they were uneducated and misunderstood almost everything I said. In fact,
I am beginning to fear that this whole mess is going to go on for quite some time, all because he records my words improperly.
Silence fell. Now both sick eyes stared heavily at the prisoner.
I repeat, but for the last time, stop feigning insanity, you scoundrel,
Pilate said softly and monotonously.
What's been recorded about you is not much, but it is enough to hang you.
No, no, Hegemon, said the prisoner, straining in his effort to convince. This one man keeps following me with a goatskin parchment and writing incessantly. I saw his parchment once, and it horrified me. I hadn't said a single thing that was written there. I begged him, burn that thing for God's sake. But he tore it out of my hands and ran off.
Who is he?
Pilate asked with distaste, feeling his temple with his hand. Matthew Levi, the prisoner gladly explained. He was a tax collector when I first met him on the road to Bethphage, by the corner of a fig orchard that juts out there, and we got to talking. At first he was unfriendly, and even insulted me. Or rather, he thought he was insulting me by calling me a dog. The prisoner smirked. I personally see nothing wrong with that particular animal to be upset at the name. The secretary stopped writing and stealthily cast a surprised glance, but at the procurator, not the prisoner. However, after listening to me, he began to warm up, Yeshua continued. At last, he threw his money to the ground and said he would travel with me. The procurator laughed with one side of his face, baring his yellow teeth, and turning his entire body towards the secretary, said,
Oh, the city of Yerushalayim. The things you'll hear in it. A tax collector, you see, threw his money to the ground.
Unsure of how to respond, the secretary decided the best course of action would be to mimic Pilate's grin.
He said that henceforth he found all money repugnant, Yeshua explained, regarding Matthew Levi's strange behaviour, and added, Since then he has been my companion.
Still leering, the procurator glanced at the prisoner, then at the sun that rose steadfastly over the mounted statues of the hippodrome, far below and to the right. Suddenly, in some fit of nauseating misery, it occurred to him that it would be easiest to simply expel this odd villain from the balcony with but two words.
Hang him.
Expel the guards as well. Leave the colonnade for the palace interior. Order the blinds drawn. Collapse on the bed. Demand cold water. Call desolately for his dog, Banger. Complain to him about the hemicrania.
And the thought of poison flashed seductively in the procurator's swollen head.
He looked at the prisoner with clouded eyes and was silent for a moment, trying painfully to remember why a man, disfigured by beatings, now stood before him in Yerushalayim's merciless morning sunlight,
and what further useless questions needed to be asked. Matthew Levi?
The sick man asked, hoarsely, closing his eyes.
Yes, Matthew Levi,
came a high-pitched voice tormenting him.
And still, what was it you said about the temple to the marketplace mob?
The responding voice seemed to stab Pilate straight through the temple. It was unspeakably torturous, and it spoke thus.
I said, Hegemon, that the temple of old faith will fall, and a new temple of truth will rise. I said so to make it clearer.
Why did you confuse the marketplace crowd, you tramp, with some truth of which you have no conception? What is truth?
And then the procurator thought,
Oh, God, I am asking him useless drivel at a trial. My mind serves me no longer.
And again he imagined a chalice of dark liquid.
Poison. Give me poison.
Again he heard the voice. The truth is, first of all, that your head aches, and so badly that you entertain craven notions of death. You are not merely incapable of speaking to me, but you can barely look at me. And right now, I am your involuntary torturer,
which upsets me.
You cannot even think straight, and you wish only for your dog, presumably the only creature you feel any attachment to. But your suffering will now end. Your head will be cured. The secretary stared at the prisoner, the writing unfinished. Pilate raised his tortured eyes at the prisoner and saw that the sun now hung rather high above the hippodrome, that a ray had found its way into the colonnade and was creeping towards Yeshua's sandals, that Yeshua was backing away from the sun. The procurator rose from his seat, clutched his head in his hands, and horror appeared on his clean-shaven face. But he willed it away immediately and lowered himself back in the chair. Meanwhile, the prisoner continued his speech. But the secretary no longer wrote anything down. Stretching his neck out like a goose, he was trying not to miss a single word. "There. It's all over," the prisoner was saying, gazing benevolently at Pilate. "And I am very glad. I would advise you, Hegemon, to leave the palace a while and take a walk somewhere nearby, say, in the gardens on Mount Iliona." The prisoner turned, squinting at the sun. "The thunderstorm will begin later, towards the evening. A stroll would do you much good, and I would gladly accompany you on it. Some new ideas have come to me, ones I believe you might find interesting. I would gladly share them with you, for you seem a very intelligent person." The secretary grew deathly pale and dropped his scroll to the floor. "The trouble is," continued the bound man, unimpeded by anyone, "that you have closed up and utterly lost your faith in mankind. One cannot reserve all his affection for a dog, would you not agree? Your life is needy, Hegemon." The speaker allowed himself a smile. By now, the secretary was wondering only whether to trust his ears. He had no choice but to trust them. Then he tried to picture what bizarre form the hot-tempered procurator's wrath would take at the prisoner's unprecedented gall. But though he knew the procurator well, the secretary's imagination failed. Then came the procurator's hoarse, broken voice. "Untie his hands," it said in Latin. One of the legionnaires from the guard tapped his lance on the ground, handed it to his colleague, and approached to remove the prisoner's ropes. The secretary picked up his scroll, resolving to suspend his writing and contain his surprise. "Confess," Pilate said quietly in Greek. "Are you a great healer?" "No, procurator, I am no healer," the prisoner replied, massaging his twisted, swollen, purple wrist with great satisfaction. Pilate's sharp, sullen gaze bored into the prisoner. No longer dull, his eyes had regained their familiar spark.
"I never asked you," said Pilate, "but perhaps you know Latin as well."
"Yes, I do," the prisoner replied. Pilate's yellow cheeks reddened, and he asked the prisoner in Latin,
"How did you know that I wanted to call my dog?"
"It's very simple," the prisoner replied in Latin. "You were moving your hand in the air." The prisoner reproduced Pilate's gesture, "as though you meant to pet. And your lips..."
"Yes," said Pilate.
They were silent a moment, and then Pilate asked another question in Greek.
"So you are a healer?"
"No, no," the prisoner replied briskly. "Believe me, I am no healer."
"Very well. If you wish to keep your secret, keep it. This has no direct bearing on the case. So you maintain that you did not call for the demolition, or the burning, or some other means of destroying the temple?"
"I repeat, Hegemon, I incited no man to such actions. Surely I do not seem that feeble-minded."
"Oh, no. You do not seem feeble-minded,"
the procurator said quietly, and smiled a frightening sort of smile.
"Then swear it never happened."
What is it you wish me to swear by? The untied man asked, brightening visibly.
Well, how about your life, at least? Answered the procurator. Now is high time to swear by it, for let it be known to you that it hangs by a thread.
Are you under the impression that it is you who hung it thus, Hegemon? Asked the prisoner. If so, you are greatly mistaken. Pilate flinched and answered through clenched teeth.
I can cut that thread.
Here, too, you are mistaken, the prisoner objected, smiling radiantly and shielding his face from the sun. Surely you would agree that only he who hung the thread can cut it.
Well, well, said Pilate, smiling. Now I have no doubt that Jerusalem's idle gapers followed at your heels. I don't know who hung your tongue, but it is hung well. Tell me, by the way, is it true that you entered Jerusalem by the way of Susim Gate, mounted on a donkey, accompanied by a screaming rabble that greeted you as some sort of prophet?
The procurator pointed to the scroll of parchment. The prisoner gave the procurator a perplexed look. I don't even own a donkey, Hegemon, he said. I did come to Jerusalem through Susim Gate, but I was on foot, accompanied by Matthew Levi alone, and no one shouted a thing to me, as no one here knew me then.
Do you happen to know the following people?
Pilate continued, without taking his eyes off the prisoner.
A certain Dismas, another Hestas, or a third Baraban.
I do not know these good people.
That is the truth.
That is the truth.
Now tell me, why do you constantly use the term good people? Do you call everyone that, perhaps?
Everyone, the prisoner replied. There are no evil people on earth.
First time I hear this, said Pilate, scoffing. But perhaps I have a poor grasp of life.
You may stop recording, he directed to the secretary, though the man had long since stopped recording, and continued speaking to the prisoner.
Did you read this in some Greek book?
No, I arrived at this with my own mind.
And this is what you preach?
Yes.
So take Centurion Mark, say. They call him Rat Slayer. Is he good?
Yes, answered the prisoner. He is an unfortunate man, however. Ever since the good people disfigured him, he became harsh and callous. I wonder who maimed him thus.
I will gladly tell you, Pilate replied, for I witnessed it personally. The good people threw themselves at him like dogs at a bear. The Germans snapped onto his neck, his arms, his legs. An infantry maniple was caught in a cul-de-sac and had a turma of cavalry under my command not cut in from the flank. You, philosopher, would not have been talking to Ratslayer just now. This was at the Battle of Edistavizo in the Valley of the Virgins.
If one were to have a talk with him, the prisoner said suddenly, in a wistful voice, I am certain that he would undergo a radical change.
I imagine, Pilate replied, that you would bring little joy to the legate of the legion if you decided to converse with any of his officers or soldiers. Fortunately for us all, it will never happen, and I will be the first to ensure this.
Just then, a swallow flew swiftly into the colonnade, describing a circle under the golden ceiling. It descended, just missing the face of a bronze statue in a niche with its sharp wingtip, and disappeared behind the capital of a column. Perhaps it had decided to build a nest there. During the course of its flight, a formula came together in the procurator's newly light and clear head. It went thus. The Hegemon had examined the case of the travelling philosopher Yeshua, surnamed Hanotstri,
and failed to substantiate the criminal charges laid out therein. In particular, not the slightest link was found between Yeshua's actions and the recent civil disturbances in Jerusalem. The wandering philosopher turned out to be mentally ill. Consequently, the procurator cannot confirm the Lesser Sanhedrin's death sentence. However, in view of the possibility that Hanotzri's insane utopian preaching may present a potential cause of unrest in Jerusalem, the procurator will remove Yeshua from Jerusalem and imprison him in Caesarea Stratonova on the Mediterranean, the location of the procurator's own residence. It remained but to dictate this to the secretary. The swallow's wings rustled inches above the procurator's head. The bird dashed towards the basin of the fountain and flew outside. The procurator raised his eyes to the prisoner and saw that a column of dust was glittering beside the captive man.
"Is that all for this one?" Pilate asked the secretary.
"Unfortunately, no,"
the secretary replied unexpectedly and handed Pilate another piece of parchment.
"What else is there?" Pilate asked, frowning.
After reading the text, an even greater change came over his face. Whether it was due to a surge of blood to the neck and face, or some other reason, only his skin lost its yellow hue and turned brownish-red, while his eyes seemed to collapse inside his head. The blood was probably again to blame, rushing and beating in his temples, when something happened to the procurator's vision. It appeared to him as though the prisoner's head had drifted off somewhere to be replaced by another. A golden wreath with rarely placed points rested atop this balding head. A rotting round sore, smeared with balm, adorned the forehead. The mouth was sunken and toothless, with a capricious hanging lower lip. It seemed to Pilate that the pink columns of the balcony and the roofs of Jerusalem far below had vanished, all of it drowning in the thickest green of Caprian gardens. His hearing, too, was strangely afflicted. He perceived the quiet yet menacing sound of trumpets somewhere far away, and a distinct nasal voice haughtily stretched the words, "The law concerning offence to the Imperial Highness." Then came thoughts, abrupt, scattered, and unusual. "Doomed!" And then, "We're doomed!" And another completely incongruous thought about someone's imminent immortality. Whose? For some reason, the thought of immortality brought on unbearable sorrow. Pilate tensed, purged the vision, and returned his gaze to the balcony, only to meet the prisoner's eyes again.
"Listen to me, Hanotzri," the procurator began, giving Yeshua an odd look.
The procurator's face was menacing, but his eyes were anxious.
"Have you ever said anything about the great Caesar?"
"Answer me, have you, or have you not?"
Pilate emphasized "not" a touch more than a legal proceeding would call for, and tried to project some idea through his gaze, as if wishing to implant it in Yeshua's mind. "It is always easy and pleasant to say the truth," noted the prisoner.
"I do not need to know,"
Pilate responded in a choked, angry voice,
"how pleasant or unpleasant it is for you to say the truth. You will have to say it regardless, but as you speak,
weigh every word, that is, if you wish to avoid certain and most painful death."
No one knows what happened to the procurator of Judea at that moment, but he allowed himself to raise his hand, as if to shade himself from the sun's rays, and from beneath the shield of his hand, to send the prisoner a sort of hinting look.
"So then," he said, "tell me if you know a certain Judas of Kiryat, and what exactly, if anything, you have said to him about Caesar."
"It happened as follows," the prisoner began, narrating eagerly.
The day before yesterday, I met a young man by the temple who called himself Judas of Kiryat. He invited me to his home in the lower city and treated me to...
A good man?
Pilate asked, and devilish fire flashed in his eyes. A very good and inquisitive man, the prisoner confirmed. He expressed the greatest interest in my ideas and received me quite warmly.
Lit the candles,
Pilate said through clenched teeth, matching the prisoner's tone, and his eyes glimmered. Yes, continued Yeshua, mildly surprised at the procurator's knowledge. He asked me to share my views on the rule of our government. This question interested him immensely.
And what did you say?
Asked Pilate.
Or are you going to claim you've forgotten what you said?
But hopelessness had already crept into his voice. Among other things, recounted the prisoner, I had said that any sort of rule is a form of violence exercised over people, and that there will come a time when there will be neither rule of Caesar's nor any other rule. Man will enter the kingdom of truth and justice, where no rule will be necessary.
What else?
Nothing else, said the prisoner. At that point, some men ran in, tied me up, and took me to prison. Trying to catch everything, the secretary penned words briskly on the parchment.
The world has never known, nor will ever know, a rule greater or more magnificent for men than that of the Emperor Tiberius.
Pilate shouted, his torn, sickly voice growing louder. The procurator glared hatefully at the secretary and the guards.
And it is not your place to debate it, criminal madman. Remove the guards from the balcony,
he yelled. Turning to the secretary, Pilate added,
Leave me alone with the criminal. This is a state case.
The guards lifted their lances and left the balcony for the garden, evenly tapping their iron-shod calligae. The secretary followed the guards. For a while, only the fountain's song interrupted the silence on the balcony. Pilate watched the dome of liquid as it billowed over the spout, as its edges broke off, as they cascaded down in droplets. The prisoner spoke first. I see that some trouble has come of my conversation with that young man from Kiryat. I have a premonition, Hegemon, that some great misfortune will befall him, and I very much pity him.
I believe, the procurator replied with a curious smile, that there are people in this world you should pity more than Judas of Kiryat, people who will end up much worse than Judas.
So then, Mark Ratslayer, who is a cold and committed torturer, along with people who, as I see, the procurator gestured at Yeshua's broken face, have beaten you for your teachings, the bandits Dismas and Hestas, who with the help of their associates killed 4 soldiers, and finally the filthy traitor Judas. They are all good people.
Yes, answered the prisoner.
And the kingdom of truth will come?
It will come, Hegemon,
Yeshua responded with conviction.
It will never come!
Pilate cried out suddenly, in a voice so terrible that Yeshua shrank away. Many years ago, in the Valley of the Virgins, it was thus that Pilate cried to his horsemen,
Cut them down! Cut them down! They've got the giant rat slayer!
He further raised his voice, torn by years of commands, shouting the words so they would be heard in the garden.
Criminal! Criminal! Criminal!
And then, lowering his voice, he asked, Yeshua HaNotzri, do you believe in any gods?
God is one, replied Yeshua. I believe in him.
Then pray to him. Pray well. Not that it will help. Pilate's voice deflated.
No wife, Pilate asked miserably, unsure of what was happening to him.
No, I am alone.
Despicable city,
the procurator suddenly muttered out of nowhere, then shrugged his shoulders as though he was cold and rubbed his hands as if washing them.
Had they murdered you right before your meeting with Judas of Kiryat, truly it would have been better.
You ought to let me go, Hegemon, the prisoner appealed suddenly, alarm creeping into his voice. I see they want to kill me. A spasm contorted Pilate's face as he turned the whites of his swollen eyes, enveloped in red strands of blood vessels, towards Yeshua and said,
Do you suppose that the Roman procurator would release a man who has said what you have said, poor bastard?
Oh, gods! Ye gods! Or perhaps you think I am willing to take your place?
I do not share your thoughts. Moreover, listen. If, from this moment on, you say another word or speak to another soul, beware. I repeat, beware.
Hegemon,
silence!
Cried Pilate, tracing with frenzied eyes the path of the swallow, which had returned to the balcony.
Get back here!
He yelled. After the secretary and the guards had returned to their places, Pilate announced that he was confirming the death sentence pronounced by the assembly of the Lesser Sanhedrin on the criminal Yeshua HaNotzri, and the secretary recorded Pilate's words. A minute later, Mark the Ratslayer again stood before the procurator. The centurion was ordered to surrender the prisoner to the head of the secret police and deliver the procurator's order that Yeshua HaNotzri be separated from the other condemned men. The men of the secret police were also to be prohibited under harshest penalty from conversing with Yeshua on any subject or responding to any of his questions. At Mark's signal, the guards surrounded Yeshua and led him off the balcony. Subsequently, a slim and handsome man with a light-coloured beard appeared before the procurator. Lion heads shone on his breastplate. Eagle feathers decorated the crest of his helmet. Golden studs lined his sword belt. His triple-soled boots were laced up to his knees, and a purple cloak was draped over his shoulder. It was the legate in command of the legion. The procurator asked him where the Sebastian cohort was presently located. The legate informed him that the Sebastians had surrounded the square in front of the hippodrome, where the criminal sentence would be announced to the people. The procurator then instructed the legate to take two sentries from the Roman cohort. One of these, led by Ratslayer, would guard the prisoners and the carts transporting the executioners and their tools on the way to Bald Mountain. Once there, it would form a cordon at the top. The other would immediately be sent to the same mountain to set up a preliminary cordon. To further protect the mountain, the procurator asked the legate to dispatch the auxiliary cavalry regiment, the Syrian Ala. When the legate left the balcony, the procurator ordered the secretary to invite the president of the Sanhedrin, two of its members, and the head of the temple guard to the palace, but added that he wanted to arrange a private conversation with the president in advance of the general meeting. The procurator's orders were executed swiftly and precisely. The sun, scorching Yerushalayim with uncanny rage these days, had not even time to reach its apex when on the upper terrace of the garden, by the two white marble lions guarding the staircase, the procurator met with the current president of the Sanhedrin, Judean High Priest Joseph Caipha. The garden was quiet. But as he emerged from beneath the colonnade onto the sun-soaked upper terrace of the garden, full of palm trees on monstrous elephantine trunks, the entirety of his detested Yerushalayim unfolded before the procurator, with all of its suspended bridges, fortresses, and most important, the marble hulk with golden dragon scales for a roof defying all description, the Temple of Yerushalayim. Far below, where a stone wall separated the palace garden's lower terraces from the city square, the procurator's acute hearing detected a low rumble, broken at times by faint, sharp noises, half groans, half cries. The procurator realised that a massive mob of Yerushalayim's inhabitants, unsettled by recent disturbances, had already gathered on the square in anticipation of the pronouncing of the sentence, and that the water merchants were clamouring anxiously among the crowd. The procurator began by inviting the high priest onto the balcony to escape the merciless heat. But Caiapha excused himself politely and explained that he could not do so. Pilate then placed his hood over his slightly balding head and began to speak. The conversation continued in Greek. Pilate said that he had examined the case of Yeshua HaNotzri and confirmed the death sentence. As a result, those to be executed today include the three bandits, Dismas, Hestas, and Barabban, and also this Yeshua HaNotzri. The first two, who have taken it in their heads to stir up rebellion against Caesar, have been apprehended in a struggle by Roman authorities. They are within the jurisdiction of the procurator, and therefore will not be discussed here. The latter two, Barabban and HaNotzri, have been arrested by local authorities and sentenced by the Sanhedrin. According to law, according to custom, one of these two criminals is to be set free in honour of the great holiday of Passover that begins today. And so the procurator would like to know which of the two criminals the Sanhedrin intends to free, Barabban or HaNotzri. Caiapha bowed his head to indicate he understood the question and replied,
"The Sanhedrin requests the release of Barabban."
The procurator knew perfectly well what the high priest's answer would be, and his task lay in showing that the answer astonished him. This he achieved with considerable skill. The eyebrows on the haughty face rose, and the procurator stared directly into the high priest's eyes with bewilderment.
"I must admit that your reply surprises me," the procurator began softly. "I fear there may be some misunderstanding here."
Pilate explained himself. "The Roman authority in no way aims to encroach on the rights of the local spiritual authority, as the high priest well knows, but this situation is clearly a case of error. Naturally, the Roman authority is interested in the correction of said error. After all, the crimes of Barabban and HaNotzri are hardly commensurate in their seriousness. While the latter, clearly an insane man, is guilty of pronouncing clumsy speeches that disturbed the populace of Yerushalayim and certain other areas, the former stands convicted of far more serious offences. Not only has he allowed himself to call directly for insurrection, but he has also killed a sentry while resisting arrest. Barabban is far more dangerous than HaNotzri. In view of the aforementioned, the procurator requests that the high priest reconsider his decision and set free the convict who presents the least harm, which is undoubtedly HaNotzri. So?" Caiapha looked Pilate straight in the eyes and said, quietly but firmly, that the Sanhedrin had carefully acquainted itself with the case and stood by its decision to free Barabban. "What? Even after my intervention? An intervention by one who speaks for the Roman authority? Say it a third time, high priest."
"For the third time, we inform you that we are releasing Barabban,"
Caiapha said quietly. It was all over, and nothing more remained to be said. HaNotzri was leaving forever, with no one left to treat the procurator's horrific, vile headaches. They had no cure now but death. But this was not the thought that struck Pilate at that moment. The same incomprehensible sorrow that had visited him previously on the balcony now pierced his entire being. He quickly sought to explain it, and the cause he found was strange indeed. It occurred vaguely to the procurator that he had not finished discussing something with the prisoner, or perhaps he had not finished listening to him. Pilate chased the thought away, and it flew off as quickly as it had come. It flew off, but the sorrow remained unexplained. For it was certainly not explained by his subsequent thought, one that lit up and faded quicker than lightning.
Immortality. Immortality has come.
Whose immortality had come? That, too, the procurator failed to understand. But the thought of this mysterious immortality chilled him to the bone, even in the blazing sun.
Very well, said Pilate. So be it.
He looked around, surveying the part of the world visible to him, and was surprised at the change that had taken place. Gone was the rose bush, heavy with flowers. Gone were the cypresses framing the upper terrace. Gone was the pomegranate tree and the white statue surrounded by greenery. And finally, the greenery itself. A maroon haze swam around him, a swaying mass of seaweed that floated somewhere and carried Pilate with it. Suffocated and scalded, he was borne aloft by the worst kind of rage. Impotent rage.
I need air, said Pilate. I need air.
His cold, clammy hand tore at the buckle on his collar, sending his cape falling to the sand.
It is stuffy today. A thunderstorm draws near,
Caiaphas replied, without taking his eyes off the procurator's red face, foreseeing all the suffering yet to come. Oh, what a horrible month of Nisan this year.
No,
said Pilate.
It is not the stuffiness, but your presence that stifles me, Caiapha.
Pilate smiled, narrowing his eyes, and added,
Be careful, high priest.
The high priest's dark eyes sparkled, and he put on an expression of surprise no less convincing than the procurator's earlier effort.
What is this I hear, procurator?
Caiapha replied calmly and proudly.
You threaten me after a sentence you confirmed yourself. Can this be?
We are used to the Roman procurator choosing his words wisely before speaking. What if someone were to hear us, hegemon? Pilate looked at the high priest with lifeless eyes and bared his teeth in a smile.
Of course not, high priest. Who could hear us here now? Do I look like some young, wandering, holy fool who will be executed today? Am I a boy, Caiapha? I know what I say and where I say it. The garden is surrounded, the palace is surrounded, and so well that not even a mouse can slip through a crack. Why, not just a mouse, but even that one, what's his face, from Kiryat, cannot slip through. By the way, would you happen to know such a man, high priest? Yes. Had someone like that slipped in here, he would have bitterly regretted it, as you would surely agree. Know then, high priest, that henceforth there will be no peace for you, neither you nor your people.
And Pilate pointed far to the right, where the temple glinted high in the air.
This I tell you, I, Pontius Pilate, Knight of the Golden Lance.
I know, the black-bearded Caiapha replied fearlessly, and his eyes flashed. Raising his hand to the sky, he continued,
The Judean people know that you despise them with violent hatred, and that much suffering you will lay upon them, but you will not destroy them.
God will protect us.
The almighty Caesar himself shall hear of our plight and defend us from Pilate, the doom-bringer.
Oh, no!
Pilate exclaimed, feeling more and more relieved with every word. No longer did he have to pretend to choose his words.
Too often have you complained about me to Caesar, and now my hour has come, Caiapha. Now I shall send word, and not to the viceroy in Antioch, not to Rome, but straight to Capria, to the emperor himself. Word of how you keep convicted rebels from death. And it won't be water from Solomon's pond, as I once intended for your benefit, that Yerushalayim will drink. No, not water. Recall how you forced me to remove shields with the imperial cipher from the walls, to shift troops around, and finally to come here myself, as you can see, to find out what was going on. Mark my words, high priest.
It won't be just one cohort that you will see in Yerushalayim. No. The entire Fulminata Legion will come under the city walls, along with the Arab cavalry. Then will you hear bitter weeping and lament. Then will you remember the rescuer Bar-Rabban and regret that you sent the philosopher with his peaceful sermon to his death. Spots of colour appeared on the high priest's face. His eyes were aflame. Like the procurator, he wore a toothy grin as he said, "Do you yourself believe what you have just said, procurator?" "No, you do not. It is not peace that this beguiler has brought to the people of Yerushalayim, knight. You understand that perfectly well. You wanted to release him so that he could stir up the population, defile the faith, and lead the people straight onto Roman swords. But I, the high priest of Judea, will not allow the desecration of faith while I live. I will protect my people. Do you hear me, Pilate?"
And Caiaphas raised his hand menacingly.
"Listen, procurator."
He fell silent, and the procurator again heard the clamouring, as though ocean waves were crashing at the very walls of Herod the Great's garden. The noise rose towards the procurator from below, past his feet, and up to his face. And behind his back, from beyond the palace wings, came distressed trumpet calls, accompanied by the heavy crunching of hundreds of feet and the clanging of metal. The procurator realized that his order was being carried out. The Roman infantry was already setting out on the execution parade that struck fear into the hearts of bandits and mutineers.
"Can you hear it, procurator?"
the high priest repeated quietly.
"Surely you don't mean to tell me that all this..."
The high priest raised both arms, and the dark hood fell from his head.
"Is on account of the pathetic bandit Bar-Rabban?"
The procurator wiped his cold, wet forehead with the back of his hand. He looked at the ground, then squinted at the sky and saw that the blazing fireball was almost directly above his head, and that Caiaphas' shadow had shrunk completely near the lion's tail.
"Noon draws closer,"
he said in a quiet, indifferent tone.
"We have become distracted by our conversation, and meanwhile it is time to proceed."
Excusing himself to the high priest with several choice phrases, Pilate asked him to sit on the bench in the shade of the magnolia and wait while he summoned the rest of the necessary persons for a quick final conference and issued one more order concerning the execution. Placing his hand on his heart, Caiaphas bowed politely and remained in the garden while Pilate returned to the balcony. The procurator ordered his waiting secretary to invite the legate of the legion and the tribune of the cohort to the garden, in addition to the two members of the Sanhedrin and the head of the temple guard. These last three had been awaiting his summons on a lower terrace in a round gazebo by the fountain. Pilate added that he would join them shortly and retreated inside the palace. While the secretary was gathering the conference, the procurator met with another man in a room heavily shaded from the sun with dark blinds. A man whose hood covered half his face, even though the sun's rays could not possibly have bothered him there. The meeting was extremely brief. The procurator quietly said several words to the man, who left immediately thereafter, while Pilate walked back through the colonnade to the garden. There, in the presence of all he had wished to see, the procurator dryly and solemnly verified that he confirmed the death sentence on Yeshua and Nozri, and officially inquired of the Sanhedrin members as to which criminal they wished to set free. Upon receiving the name of Bar-Rabban in response, the procurator said, "Very well," and ordered the secretary to record this immediately in the proceedings. He grasped his buckle, which the secretary had lifted from the sand, and said solemnly,
"It is time."
All those present set off down the broad marble staircase between two walls of rose bushes that emitted their stupefying aroma, and travelled lower and lower towards the palace wall to a set of gates that led to a large, smoothly paved square, where the columns and statues of the Yerushalayim Hippodrome stood at the far end. As soon as the group emerged from the garden and stepped upon a wide stone platform raised high above the square, Pilate narrowed his eyelids and assessed the situation. The space that he had just crossed, being the stretch from the palace wall to the platform, was empty. But ahead of him, the square itself could not be seen. It had been swallowed up by the crowd. The crowd would have poured onto the platform and the cleared space as well, were it not held back by a triple row of Sebastian soldiers to Pilate's left, and a similar arrangement from the Iturian auxiliary cohort to his right. And so Pilate ascended the platform, squinting, mechanically clutching the unnecessary buckle in his fist. He was not squinting because the sun burned his eyes. No, for some reason he did not wish to see the group of prisoners, who, as he well knew, were being led onto the platform behind him. The instant the white cape, with its dark red lining, appeared high at the top of the stone cliff over the edge of the human sea, a wave of sound struck the sightless pilot's ears. It began quietly, far away by the hippodrome, then grew into something truly thunderous and held for several seconds before beginning to fade. "They've seen me," thought the procurator. The wave never reached its lowest point. Resurging suddenly, it wavered and rose high above the first peak, and just as foam boils on an ocean wave, whistles and scattered women's moans boiled on the wave of sound discernible through the thunder. "That was them being led onto the platform," thought Pilate, "and the screams are from several women who were crushed as the crowd pushed forward." He waited a length of time, knowing that no power could silence the mob until it had expelled all that had pent up within it and quieted down on its own. And when the proper moment came, the procurator threw up his right hand and blew away the last wisps of noise from the crowd. Then Pilate gathered as much of the hot air as he could into his chest and shouted, his torn voice carrying over thousands of heads, "In the name of the Emperor Caesar!" A chopped metallic roar struck his ears several times. Throwing up their lances and standards, the soldiers in the cohorts cried out fearsomely, "Long live Caesar!" Pilate raised his head and thrust it directly into the sun. A green fire flared up under his eyelids, igniting his brain, and hoarse Aramaic words flew over the crowd. "Four criminals arrested in Yerushalayim for murder, incitement of rebellion, and disregard for law and faith are sentenced to a disgraceful death by hanging on posts. This execution will now take place at the top of Bald Mountain. The names of the criminals are Dismas, Hestas, Barabban, and Hanotsri. Here they stand before you." Pilate gestured with his hand to the right, not looking at the criminals, but knowing they were in place as they should be. The crowd responded with a prolonged clamour, as if surprised or relieved. When it died down, Pilate carried on. "However, only three of them will be executed, for according to law and custom, in honour of the holiday of Passover, as chosen by the Lesser Sanhedrin and approved by the Roman authority, the magnanimous Caesar will restore to one of the condemned his shameful life." Even as Pilate cried out the words, he heard the din replaced by a great silence. Not a single breath, not a rustle now reached his ears, and for a moment it even seemed to Pilate
that everything around him had disappeared entirely. The city he so hated had died, and he alone stood there, scorched by the vertical rays, his face wedged in the sky. Pilate held the silence a moment longer, and then began to shout.
"The name of the man who will now be set free before you."
He took another pause, delaying the name, verifying that he had said all that needed to be said, for he knew that the dead city would be resurrected the moment he pronounced the name of the fortunate one, and no further words would be heard.
"Is this it?" Pilate whispered noiselessly to himself. "Yes, the name."
And, rolling the R over the silent city, he shouted,
"Bar Rabban!"
It was as though the sun rang and exploded above, flooding his ears with fire. Howls, screams, moans, laughter and whistles raged in this fire. Pilate turned and headed back across the platform towards the steps, looking at nothing but the multicoloured floorboards under his feet so as not to stumble. He knew that behind him a hail of bronze coins and dates was falling on the platform, that people in the howling crowd were crushing and climbing over each other to see the miracle for themselves. How a man already in the grasp of death had somehow wrestled free from that grasp. How the legionnaires removed his ropes, involuntarily causing searing pain to his arms, sprained at the interrogation. How, frowning and moaning, he still managed to smile a senseless, deranged smile. He knew that, at the same time, the guards were already leading the three bound men towards the side steps to take them on the road due west out of the city to Bald Mountain. Only after he had put the platform behind him did Pilate open his eyes. Knowing that he was safe, the condemned were out of sight. The waning moans of the crowd now mingled with the piercing shouts of heralds, who repeated, some in Aramaic and others in Greek, all that the procurator had said on the platform. Then Pilate's ears caught the regular clattering of approaching horses' hooves and a quick, merry trumpet call. These sounds were met with piercing whistles from boys on the roofs of the street connecting the marketplace to the Hippodrome Square, and cries of "Watch out!" A lone soldier standing in the cleared space waved his standard anxiously, and then the procurator, the legate of the legion, the secretary, and the guards all stopped. At an increasingly faster trot, the cavalry ailer flew out onto the square, aiming to cross it on the side, avoiding the mass of people, and take the shortest path to Bald Mountain, by way of a grapevine-covered alley that hugged the stone wall. Trotting past Pilate, the commander of the ailer, a Syrian, small as a boy and dark as a mulatto, shouted something in a high-pitched voice and drew his sword from its scabbard. His mean, sweating black horse started rearing on its hind legs. Throwing his sword back into the scabbard, the commander struck the horse on the neck with his whip, straightened it out, and rode off down the alley, breaking into a gallop. In rows of three, the rest of the riders flew in a cloud of dust behind him, the tips of their light bamboo lances flickering in the air. Their faces swept past the procurator, looking particularly dark under the white turbans, displaying happy grins and shining teeth. Raising dust to the sky, the ailer tore into the alley, and the last to pass Pilate was a soldier with a shining trumpet on his back. Shielding himself from the dust with his hand and wrinkling his face in displeasure, Pilate pressed on, heading towards the palace gates. After him came the legate, the secretary, and the guards. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning.